Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Okay, let's start back up with the question right here. Let's bring the microphone.
Right here I have a copy of your article from stayLDS.com about staying in the church, and I was wondering if you could address the subject of moving past the true-false or binary world, as you put it. The way I look at it is, or that makes sense, applying it to the church as a whole and different concepts. They may be true, they may be false, official doctrine, not official doctrine, but when the way I see it is you apply it to individual issues, and more specifically the one and only true church concept, and in my mind that's either true or it's false. How do you find middle ground in that?
It's a great question. It's a bold claim for the church to say that, in spite of being less than 0.5% of the world's population, it's the one and only true church with exclusive priesthood authority, and all other religions and ordinances performed are illegitimate. That's a pretty bold claim. I think that's part of its success and growth. I think that as the church ever tries to back away from that, it probably won't see continued prosperity. So I think that the brethren that talk that way are sincere and they believe it, and I also think that that's the best way to have a healthy, thriving religion that I've seen. I think there are exceptions to that where a charismatic pastor can get 4,000 people to attend his local church, but if you're going to create a religious movement worldwide, you're not going to do it saying, yeah, they're good, we're good, everybody's good, so come on, you know. So, I mean, I understand where the true-false paradigm comes from in terms of the church, and I think that they're sincere and smart to emphasize that, but I think it obviously sets them up for increased scrutiny. And so when Gordon B. Hinckley says this is either everything it claims to be or the greatest fraud that's ever been perpetrated, that's going to make a lot of people take that challenge seriously, and I think it's led a lot of people out of the church. So I don't doubt the fact that either Joseph had something like he claimed or he made it up. I think one of those two things is likely true, and one of them is likely false. But fortunately, religion thrives in the world of the unprovable and the unknowable. And no one's ever going to be able to go back and know what experience Joseph actually really did or didn't have. And that is the good fortune that religion rests upon. So the rest of us have to just decide what we think. But in reality, either decision's going to be somewhat of a leap of faith. And anybody who says that God doesn't exist is taking a leap of faith and can be just as zealous and dogmatic about their atheism as any Mormon can be about theirs. And so, you know, is pedophilia bad? I think that's pretty clear. Is murdering someone in cold blood bad? I think that's pretty clear. And did some things happen and other things not happen? I think, yeah. I think it's going to be hard to ever take something that's withstood the test of time from a religious perspective and be able to draw a really clear conclusion. I don't think that you could ever say that all you have to do is read a certain amount of books and be a certain level of IQ, and you will conclude that the church isn't what it claims to be. Because I've met Richard Bushman, and I've met Armand Moss, and I've met Bill Bradshaw, and maybe some of you here who know all the historical problems and inaccuracies and yet remain literalistic, absolute, true believers. I'm coming out with a podcast with Bill Bradshaw in a couple weeks that I filmed last Friday. And that man has been through tough times at BYU. He's got a son who's gay. He's one of the foremost activists for gay rights. He's a biologist who believes heartily in evolution and has spent his life teaching it. And he is a literal believer in the truthfulness of the church without any apology. Well, I think that he probably has a broader view of goodness and a conviction to withhold judgment as to what heaven's like and who goes where and how we should judge or condemn others who aren't of our faith. But I think if you were to ask him, does he believe that Joseph was a prophet of God, I think he would say yes. And I think he would say that Joseph had the vision he had and that the authority, and I'm speaking for him, so I could be wrong, but I think that he would say that the priesthood authority that we claim to have, that he would believe in that. Okay, and there's a middle ground between the true and the false as it relates to the church and its origins. You can believe that the Book of Mormon is an inspiring and inspired document, that somehow, in some twisted way, God, through his power and influence, orchestrated the production of that book to the betterment of mankind. I've even heard Grant Palmer, who has explicitly invalidated the church's truth claims, say that he believes the Book of Mormon brings people to Christ and it should be read and celebrated. And you could say the same thing about Joseph Smith and the church, that it was messy and maybe it's not exclusively true, but maybe our church is as good or as true as any other and maybe even the best. And maybe God's hand was in this whole thing. And so there's inspiration and value there, even if it's not literalistically exclusively true. So that's a middle ground that a lot of people feel comfortable walking. And I think most of the members that I've sat down and said, is this really the one and only true church on the face of the earth and all others are illegitimate? A lot of them are like, I don't know. It's just a great place to raise your kids. You know what I mean? That's what they'll say in private. That's not what they'll say in front of their kids or in front of a lot of times. But, you know, we live in a practical world. I'll just say this. If ever you get a chance to read an author called Chaim Potok, P-O-T-O-K, he's written several books. One's called The Chosen, one's called The Promise, one's called My Name is Asher Lev, and one's called Davida's Harp. And he explores the modernity of Judaism. And the Jews and the Catholics have figured this out way ahead of us. Because I know plenty of Catholic friends who say, I think the Pope's full of crap, and I use birth control, and I'm pro-choice, but I'm a Catholic, and no one can tell me that I'm not. Even though those three things are fundamentally opposed to Catholic teachings and doctrine. And anybody know what the largest branch of Judaism in the United States is? Reform Judaism. Did you know that a Reform rabbi can be an atheist and still be a rabbi? You can deny that Moses ever really existed and still be a rabbi in Reform Judaism. And that's the predominant form of Judaism in the United States. So other religions that are more mature have figured out that there's value in the culture and the heritage and the myth and the tradition and the hymns. But, you know, but we don't have to believe all the stupid stuff. Mormons are young and still somewhat thriving, and so we haven't gotten there. But at some point, the information and the critical mass is going to tip, I predict, and whether it's the homosexuality issue or more information about church history or some Paul Dunn-like scandal or Mark Hoffman-like scandal, in the next 100 years, there's going to be a certain tipping point and a breaking point where the church is going to have to create room for non-traditional, unorthodox, metaphorical views, or even heretics. Or it's going to just lose everybody.
We tipped once before.
Yeah, I mean, we've tipped several times. And so I think the church is going to become more and more accommodating, but I think it's going to take a lot of time. And some of us may be around and some of us may not be. Okay. Yes?
I just like to comment on the subject of the problems of raising your kids when you're not terribly orthodox. I've got kids who I have a very close relationship with, and they've turned out amazingly well, and quite orthodox members of the church, in spite of the fact that their dad's a heretic. And I looked at it, you don't want to totally desert the church when you realize that, you know, out in the outside world, you got 35% illegitimacy and an awful lot of other problems out there. But I just always told my kids, I like you going to church. I think it's a great thing. I just don't want you to end up being a blind, unquestioning believer. You know, that's always the thing I told them. Don't be a blind, unquestioning believer. But other than that, get what you can out of it.
Thank you. That's great. Great advice from someone a little more experienced than me, that's for sure.
I have a question. So I had a real crisis of faith about a year ago when I read God's Problem. And so it was more than just with the church. It was with God. And so I want to be more like Kim. because he's like stays in the church, but I feel like I need to get over this big hump, and I'm in this, I don't know, lost area right now. I've talked to my bishop about it, and that was kind of a disaster, but not exactly because he's my friend, but I don't know, gave me my temple recommend after a little bit, but you know, I had to answer no to most of the questions. He wanted me to be honest, so I said those are the first five, and he said, okay, we can't have to stop. But anyway, so I feel like, anyway, so after after this big hump, I don't know how to get over this hump to back to be feeling comfortable with God and comfortable with church, and I feel like I've lost my faith, and I feel like I want to get it back, but I don't know if that's possible, having been completely faithful my whole life and then having this crisis. And so it's more than just with the church, it's with God, and that bothers me, but I don't want to leave. I'm not leaving. My ward's great. You know, and there's a lot of people so far still in my ward that are staying, but they're leaving gradually. And a real close friend of mine and her family are taking a sabbatical, but I don't think they're coming back. So anyway, if I could help me in this gray area until I can get back into it.
I'll tell you, I can't ever presume to think that how I've reconciled the God question is going to help you. But if it helps, I'll share with you. Most people that I've worked with who have lost their testimony in the church end up quickly losing their testimony in the Bible, in Jesus, and in God, and at least experience a season of atheism or agnosticism. Because it's just so tightly interwoven and authoritative that you become so disenchanted. You don't want to trust anybody. You don't want anything to do with religion because you feel so disappointed and deceived and disenfranchised and frustrated. You can't trust anybody. Maybe that's a little bit of how you felt. So yeah, it's very easy for all that to unravel, and I've been there. And I guess for me it starts with just a simple decision. Like, it really is just like I could go this way or this way, I'm gonna go this way. Not that this way is the right way. I just have to pick, or I'm gonna just keep standing here. So I start from the belief that in important times in my life, when I've had a righteous wish or desire, and I've put my efforts towards that righteous goal or ambition, I've felt power and communication and influence buoy me up and support me in those things. And something like Mormon Stories, or the fact that all of you are here listening, like, it's just crazy that that would be possible. And I feel like something's happened where power greater than my own has somehow played an influence in all that. And I've felt moments of inspiration and emotion that I think is more than emotion, personally. And so, like, I slap God as the label on that. Now, whether that has 10 fingers and 10 toes or a beard or is a male or a female or, like, you know, three husbands and one wife or four wives and a husband, like, I don't know. I'm not invested anymore in, like, how personal that God is, how powerful that God is. I really can't believe in an omniscient, omnipresent, all-powerful God. As Brian Dalton called it in a podcast, the big G God. It's just hard to believe with all the horrible tragedies that happen in this world. You know, just like the Mormon plan of salvation, that there'd be one correct path for God's children to follow, yet very tiny slivers throughout the entire human existence have had even access, basic access, to being part of that plan. You know, even now, it's growth of its zenith of power and influence, it's, you know, 4 or 5 million active members in a world of 6 billion people. Like, if that's the best God can do, I'm like thinking, I'm not sure he's powerful enough for me to really, like, be too invested in. I mean, I'm not, and you can tie it all back to our worthiness in the preexistence, and we were awesome, weren't we? But I mean, so like a big G God is just something that so if I make my God nebulous, it can still feel very personal and real to me, and it doesn't have to be with a beard and, you know, walking on marble, you know, and whatever else. So that's where I start. It's a decision, and then I guess I've decided that if I had to choose between, Glenn's laughing at me back there, if I had to choose between living in a world where there's no meaning and no purpose and no design and it's all random, that actually feels as absurd to me as the idea that there's some celestial supreme being out there that screwed everything up, but we're still here. So like both are actually equally absurd. Like if you ask me in my heart, how likely is it that this is just some random, you know, calamity of molecules that resulted in hearts and love and beauty and art and compassion and altruism? That doesn't feel right to me either. I mean, it really doesn't. Like, I think there are people who are atheists who have totally found a very comfortable, meaningful, fulfilling perspective. And I don't invalidate that at all. When I hear an atheist speak in altruistic, beautiful terms, I'm touched and moved. So I don't invalidate that. I call myself a believer. And so that's where I start. And then I try and build on top of that. And now, you know, it's amazing when I've interviewed Richard Bushman and I said, do you think about the church in terms of true and false? And he said, no, I couch my testimony in terms of goodness. My testimony of the church is built upon a foundation of the goodness that I've experienced within it. And I think that's a neat way to start building back a foundation. By their fruits you shall know them. Build upon goodness wherever you can find it. And that's something you can believe in. And I think a life of belief is a one that can be well lived. And so the other thing is, Carolyn Pearson once said, my God is bigger than any church. That'll be in the interview that comes out in a couple of weeks. I thought that was pretty cool. But that's the best I can offer, I guess. But it means a lot to me. Only after, if you have the microphone, you can. Wait.
I was trying to respond to the same thing.
Are you follow up on her or
yeah, anything? No, same thing.
Okay, Kim, then Glenn.
So one of the keys of what Richard Bushman said was not only the word goodness, but the goodness that I experience in it.
Yeah.
And to me, I want to focus on the word experience. One of the things that we often do when we think about faith or when we think about God is we think about it in terms of belief. Okay? And Alma defines faith as a species, subspecies of belief. And I think that's a mistake. Okay? I think that evidence of things not seen is a lot closer. And that the idea that I experience God, as I live my life in a certain way, I come to have a set of experiences that inform my belief system rather than the other way around. And I don't simply ask the question, does belief in God make sense in terms of a crummy world? I live my life a certain way, and I have a certain belief response to that, an experience of God. And that informs me. Anyway, that...
Beautiful.
Thanks.
It's my second kiss. You got my first.
Okay. I just wanted to ask you, because you said earlier that you lost your belief in God, but you don't want to leave. You want to stay. And I'm just curious, why? Why you want... And I don't mean that flippantly. I just...
Okay, wait.
But I think that's where the answer lies.
Okay, I'll play Phil Donahue. Okay.
Two things.
Lisa's going to respond to Glenn's question.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of reasons, I guess. Well, I'm a big supporter of gay marriage, and I live in San Francisco, and I feel like I can do good in the church by staying in the church and helping that, and I have a lot of friends in my ward that think like I do, who haven't quite left, some of them, some of them haven't. And so I get a lot of support from them and my entire family. From, you know, I'm a 12th generation Mormon. And my niece is getting married, so I'm going to cry, on Saturday, and the first of 25 nieces and nephews, and I want to support them, and I want to be in their life, and if I leave, my family will probably disown me. This is, I didn't know I was going to be so emotional, sorry. I mean, no one would let their kids come and visit. For my family, I guess. I had my first niece come and visit me just this last week, and we just dropped her off yesterday, and it was just wonderful, and we loved each other, so I don't want to lose that. And I think my family, they already have a problem with me not following the prophet on the gay marriage thing, and they think I'm going to go to hell. Some of them are joking about that, but some of them, they're worried I'm going to be lost in heaven and we're not going to be an eternal family, so that's why I'm staying.
Well. George.
I have a two-part question. One is, I guess, generally for the audience, and if you want to respond to it, is I have a 19-year-old daughter, and she's engaged to get married. And he's a returned missionary, 24 years old. So inevitably, the question is, you know, they're going to get married in the temple, and I haven't renewed my temple recommend for a year, a little bit over a year, and, you know, and I don't plan on renewing it. And so I guess, has anybody navigated through that experience with, you know, you're not ready to talk to all your kids about it or some of them, but then the inevitable question is, well, why aren't you going to be there for my wedding? That's one thing. And the second thing is, I see your mom's here, and I wanted to, if you could comment about how, you know, this, the relationship between you and your mom and your brother and your family, when you started going through your own crisis, and how your family reacted, and how, you know, what's happened in your family.
I'm more comfortable talking about other people. Okay. Does someone have an answer to his first question? Okay.
I have an answer for that, I guess. No, it's being recorded. Okay, so I'm the mother of 11 children, followed everything as was prescribed with the intention of, I was a convert at 16, then I bought the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker, believed it all, thought I did anyway, and followed everything with an intention of getting a testimony of it, because they say, you know, you have to live it first and then you'll get a testimony. Well, it never happened, never happened, never happened, never happened. Well, so about, I don't know, 13 years ago, had a big crash emotionally and everything. I only had 9 children at the time. Then I had...
We are slow learners.
Okay, so then I had, about 10 years ago, I had the experience of actually seeing another view, experiencing what he says is that when you find, what John mentioned earlier, that he's found that when people have this crash, when they come out of it, they have a different view. Either they see things in the church and they can stay, or they see things out. I had a different view of spirituality about 10 years ago, and my husband knew all along everything that was going on, but my children didn't know. So then I just kept playing the game, and every year that I had to go in for my temple recommend, that was the only time I was nervous. It was the only time that I was, like, really concerned, because I knew I was going to have to lie, or I was going to have to switch it around or twitch it, you know, and I'd have to go through this jumping through the hoops trying to make myself say yes to all those believing questions. Because it was an integrity issue for sure. Well, about 7 years ago, I talked to a bishop, and I took my temple recommend and laid it on the table, and I said, here, this is how I see God. This is how I see Christ. This is what I believe about the atonement. And all not even related to what Mormons believe at all. So I said, are you going to take my temple recommend after each time I said something? And he never took it. So then I thought, oh, good. But then I didn't have the guts when it came due to renew it to say the truth again. So I went to, you know, somebody else, and I just finally decided just before the interviews, I'd always go, oh, I'm just going to say yes, 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 no, 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 whatever, and get it over with. Well, then about a year and a half, I don't know how long ago, year and a half ago, I guess, I decided to tell the truth. And I told my husband, I'm going through the same process. Oh, I'm going to have to go in there again and tell everything. And I don't want to lie. And my husband just said, look, just tell the truth. And I said, okay. You know, I knew what the result was going to be, but he thought it wasn't going to be that way. I'm like, whatever. So I go in there and I told the truth, which left me with no temple recommend. I'd had 2 children already married in the temple. I'd already attended their temple weddings. Then a month later, my husband gives my daughter a blessing and tells her it's time for her to go to the temple. She's not getting married and she's not going on a mission, but he says, I'm thinking, oh, good grief. You had to tell her that. That's retarded. So now I'm stuck because it's going to come out, you know? And so I think, oh, they're not going to let her go because she's only 23. They won't let her go. So I'm just praying on that, not telling anybody anything. And eventually she did go. She did get permission to go. Well, at that point, I had to tell her, because the culture is that the woman goes with her daughter and escorts her in the temple. I couldn't do that. And so I just had to tell her. And then once I told her, all my children are very, very close to each other, so I knew they were all going to find out. So I'm like, well, I made that choice to tell the truth in November. So when all the truth comes out and hell hits the fan and all the older kids find out, it's like April at conference, I guess, when finally a lot of them found out, because they're, you know, they talk. And every one of my children now has been talked to and explained just that I don't believe whatever those temple recommend questions are, that I had to say no. I don't tell them what I do believe necessarily. I just say that's how it is. I don't have a temple recommend, and I'm sorry. And my daughter got married last March. I wasn't in the temple. I was getting the flowers, and I was there when she came out, and my girlfriend took over and was the mom in the temple. And then she was the mom for my son, who just went through because he's going on a mission. She was the mom in the temple then, too. And I'm like, my kids love this lady. I survived it. They survived it. And my youngest child, who's 8, just really doesn't know anything yet. You know, I haven't told him anything. He doesn't know. I mean, he sees. I don't wear the clothes that Mormons do. I don't do the, you know, I wear sleeveless clothes. And I'm just who I am now. I'm like I would have been if I had never been Mormon. I try to be, whatever that means, with 11 children. Anyway, and when I was 16, I was never getting married and never having kids. Then I joined the church, and then I started believing all the stuff. I probably never should have done it, but I did. So anyway, I survived, they survived, we're all happy. I mean, you know, as happy as a person can be, which is a TBM and believes their mom's not going to be with them in heaven, but hey, you know, that's how it is.
My turn.
Oh, he wants to say. Kind of torn, because I think part of what I want to say is probably better for this afternoon, but so I'm going to keep it short. Try to keep it short, my wife says. You know, I've been thinking. You know, earlier we were talking about what do we do raising our kids. What I heard was kind of a phrasing, sort of beating around the bush, but a phrasing of, well, you know what? I don't want my kids to have to go through stage 4. I just want to lift them from stage 3 to stage 5. Now, so the question is that going to work? And is that really an advisable thing? And my life experience informs me that we as human beings will have a crisis, at least one, maybe more. What I try to do with my kids is say, look, if you're not careful, you could end up using the church as the club or the hammer when you have a crisis and you want to strike out and you want to beat up on people. If you want to go the total TBM route, you're going to use the church as your stick of power. And if you want to run away from the church, you're going to use the church as the weapon to beat off all those people who really love you and want to put their arms around you and just say, hey, whatever it is, I'm here for you. At that point, the church doesn't matter to them. You do. And you won't let them. So, in our own points of crisis, I think what John said, you have to start with a decision, because at some point you are at nothing. There's nothing there. And you say, look, what do I want in life? What do I want to do? Now, and then just build on that and recognize the tendency to grab whatever's handy and use it as a big frying pan or as a club or whatever. And refrain from that, or apologize when you do. Recognize and say, oh, you know what, I am so sorry, this is what I just did, and I didn't want to do that. Well, I did, but, you know, make it right. Now, to our experience with our kids and Gail's experience here, yeah, that's kind of rough. we can immunize or inoculate our children against some of the, you know, more contentious issues. I find it interesting that the church architects only build the churches for like 50% activity in the first place. Seems awful strange to me. We have 11 kids. If we look at our youngest, he's 8 right now. 12 years, he'll be getting ready to get married. Let's make it 14. We'll have 26 on our side of the family. And if he marries another family, that there's not a ceiling room in this church big enough
for
just the immediate family members. Okay? What does that say? So it's just simple things like that. And the other, what I'm finally remembered, the, my main point here is that we tend to bundle things together. Marriage is not the same thing as sealing. Marriage is a community event. It's the joining of families. Sealing is a commitment between you and your spouse and God. And if we can have enough time with our children, doesn't take years, it just takes a few months, maybe, if we can lay the groundwork and be very careful about it. But we might persuade them that having a marriage and then having a sealing separate, like it's done in most countries in this world, would be a good thing. And not to collapse the experience and lose some of the joy and energy by having a two-in-one.
That's right.
But pull them apart and make them separate.
Yep.
So
real
that's
quick,
an option.
Thank you. Thank you, Johnny Gill. Thank you so much. Yeah. So, you know, that. Thank you for that perspective. I do look forward to the day where people get married so that everyone can enjoy the experience, and then if they choose to get sealed, they can do that later. I know that's complicated, but that's what I hope for. George, I don't know if we answered your question about how to handle the temple recommend. It's a tough one. You just kind of have to, everyone's got to make that decision of where they are in terms of pros and cons, what the cost is of being authentic and open versus the benefit. You have to think about if you're able to nuance things to feel good about living that middle ground. And then if at some point you feel like you can't, then you just have to do what is right and let the consequences follow. And I don't know that there's any other easier answer than that. Your second question, just about my own personal experience, I'm really, 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 really lucky. My wife, when I went through a struggle, she just went right there along with me. And we've pretty much been lockstep the whole way, both when we've been loving the church and then kind of going inactive a little bit, but then coming back and now trying to be in this middle ground. We're just like joined at the hip. So I'm really lucky that way. We're going to talk all about that this afternoon, so I don't want to talk too much about marriage. And then real quick, I'm really lucky. My mom has been a Dialogue subscriber since when, Mom? Since like the 80s?
Yes.
Yeah. So she's, you know, expressed occasional sadness about what the implications might be for my kids, her grandkids, or the family. She wants me to be thoughtful and cautious about the things I do. She doesn't want me to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But I've never, ever felt a moment of shame or disappointment on the part of either of my parents. And I think that's the fact that because they're both active, I think that's really, really unique. But I think my mom probably has somewhat of a stage 5 Fowler-like view on things. And I think that makes it possible. My siblings are all committed true believers too, but I've never felt any shame. You know, I always feel this secret disappointment that I'm a disappointment to them. I don't know that that's ever going to go away, but I don't think they've ever done anything to make me feel that way. It's just how I feel. So I'm fortunate. Most people don't have that. Mom, did you want to add anything to any of that?
I would be happy to answer any specific question, honestly, but as far as I'm afraid I might ramble if I take a, you know, the big view. One thing I could say is that I went on a journey about the same time as John did, but it was an intellectual curiosity type of a journey where I found things fascinating. Well, you know, and so it wasn't tied in with heartbreak and disappointment and I've been lied to or anything like John's was. So I'm coming from a hugely different perspective, and yet we did go on a similar journey as far as knowledge. And I've read all the books, pretty much all the books that John's read. And my husband has read all the books as a courtesy to me, and he's a true believer, as true as they come. But we do discuss things, and he has an intellectual way of looking at it, but it doesn't penetrate him. And so I don't have this heartbreak and disappointment that others have. I'm just intellectually stimulated by what I'm learning, and so any question you want to ask me.
What about your feelings for how I've ended up and then what I've done to try and help others?
Okay.
We've handled the kids.
I've had no disappointment whatsoever or heartache about John's journey personally. Some of the family members, I think, are worried. And I don't know if he's told you that his brother's a high church, has a high visible position, not as a general authority, but as a very visible position in church organization. And they look alike, and they're both highly charismatic, so it's interesting if you don't get them mixed up, because he might be a problem. So I think there are our family members who worry, and some of the grandchildren are worried. What's going on with
Uncle John?
Yeah, what's going on with him? What's this on his Facebook? This is worrisome. Do you know that he might not have a testimony? Has that ever occurred to you? What would that be like? So I don't have any fears, because I know John's heart, and I know his compulsion to be honest and to have integrity, and I always used to say he's butt honest, because he would get himself in trouble by being too honest and honest gratuitously. I mean, there's certain thing is too much information. So I love John, and I'm proud of him, and I feel very strongly that he's helping people, and that he's providing something that's very much needed at this point in time. So if you want to see me anytime and ask me any questions, I'm like John, I'm pretty honest, so I'll be happy to answer any questions.
You can see where I learned my butt honesty. Right here. And then I'm gonna do a couple more slides, and then we'll do more questions.
Just on this topic, is there a path where you can be genuine, honest, but not marginalized? I mean, we've just seen a couple stories of fear of being marginalized in your family, fear of, you know, or not fear, but reality of, you know, being marginalized and being able to participate with your family and being honest. In the church, all of a sudden, you now can't be trusted, even though you've taken a path of you're trying to be more honest, more authentic, and now you're not trusted. Is there a path?
Well, I think there is, and here are some of the factors that I think would increase your likelihood of being able to follow that path. If you have a lot of money, if you are of high social reputation, if you have a personality that is disarming, you have a very good sense of humor, and you're tactful, and if you're diplomatic, if you have some type of power, influence, or heritage that really backs you up, then I think within moderation, you can there are still lines you will not be able to cross. But in those instances, some people, I think, are able to make it work. But I think that that's a very, very small percentage. That's my experience. I see a lot of head shaking no. Toby, let's do Toby, and then I'm going to do a couple more slides, and then we'll have more discussion.
This question about the temple recommends that's come up. There's a lot of wiggle room on those temple recommend questions. You know, I mean, it depends how you take it. I mean, I know people have got answers, but for years I've objected to that question. Are you honest? You're dealing with your fellow man, or whatever that question is. Every church office I've ever brought that up would say, yeah, that's right, that's right. And they say, this is how I did figure it out, understand it. Sustaining the brethren. Yeah. What does it mean to sustain the brethren? I think it means sustain the brethren. Tell them when they're full of baloney. You know, I think that's sustaining the brethren. You know, when I don't perceive that they're in the right path. Now, there's some things you can't. You're going to get your that, but a lot of there's just a lot of wiggle room on those.
Yes, there is a lot of wiggle room on the questions. If you think about the fact that number one, they're explicitly told never to deviate from the temple recommend questions. They're not allowed to add to it. Joseph Smith's name never appears in any of the temple recommend questions. They're always framed in, do you have a testimony of, which could be anything from, I hope it's possibly true, to I have a burning conviction that it is. And then if you look at, you know, tithing isn't defined for you. They don't ask for your W-2s. They don't tell you what it has to mean to have God this or Jesus that, or what that has to mean to you in terms of do you wear your garments at night? Well, they don't say every night. They don't say all night. I mean, yes. And if any of you want to read my essay, How to Stay in the Church After Crisis of Your Faith, there's actually a section on how to nuance the temple recommend questions. It's much edited. It was much more bold, and I've cut it down to avoid potential action against me, especially the tithing section. But the only issue with that, Toby, is that in the end, there are people who come to me and say, in my heart, I know that what I mean when I answer the questions isn't what they mean when they ask it. And so for some, they end up feeling like it's unethical.
You've got to talk to yourself.
But there are all sorts of reasons why if someone feels like they need or want a temple recommend, they should feel like there's so much flexibility. Just the fact that every leader is going to interpret things differently. And there could be a leader in a Cambridge ward in Boston where you say, I don't know if I believe God exists. And he's like, that's fine. Join the club. And then you can go to some Draper, you know, bishop who's like telling you that if you don't pay 10% on your, you know, on your gross, then you're not, you know, legitimate. And it's open to so much variation. The questions are so broad. You're allowed at the end to make the own interpretation. I think that if you feel like you need or want a temple recommend, I think that there are ways to do that ethically. And the only caveat I have is that there are a lot of people who end up saying, this just doesn't feel honest anymore. So I'll just say that. Okay. Yes, we have one more comment, and then I'm going to do some slides. What?
I am a mother of six. I am from a family that is a thinking family. And I can say, having an hour in this, that the most important thing is that is you. When this young man said, we are talking to you children, you're more important than the church. And if you can't get to the point where you're more important than the church, then you've got to go and do some very healthy therapy in getting yourself to realize that you are the ultimate concern, and you really are the ultimate concern, and you are playing against goodness by trying to debate this. And the way you handle it is like Richard Bushman said, he has faith in the good in his experiences. He went away from Salt Lake and he got clout. He's a political person, but he's also an intelligent person, like we all are. And you know, he has a book out that's in our home that now the fifth one in our family is starting to read it and then to analyze at the end of it. Well, what did you get out of it? And the guy, the little guy who's my grandson, who's first year finishing BYU, read it. And everyone said, why would the mother ever let that kid read that? And I asked the mother, and the mother said, who is my daughter, my oldest daughter, who's from Berkeley, who's from Stanford, and who has, I'm bragging right now, and that's not good, is it? that isn't good. My kids wouldn't like that, but I sort of like that in a way. But you know, all you people in this room need to brag. It's you that are important. It is not anyone else. It is not anything or foundation that is above you. You are the one to create it. And you made a statement at the beginning, before we all got involved in our talk, that it's the travel of integrity, the navigating wisely through integrity and restraint, and I add to that to become whole. And every one of us in this room need to have as a desire to become whole. And if it goes to all parts of the world with all kinds of things, that's what you search after. You don't stay in this little pot. It's devastating, and God doesn't want it. And I just read, we're reading this summer because we have time on our hands, and we're trying to make money out of 18 acres of hay. But on that, he's just got through reading Bushma's book. I took the back of the book to see if this guy was meant to be what he's supposed to be all in his intellect. And I really did have to just say, I'm going to put it down. But my husband read through it, and my, who else has read through it? Well, they're all got on the coffee table. So, you know what? We're missing the boat. And this idea of which the reflections of the maturing faith, that's why we're here. That's the motto for this week. And so you, myself, anything that is very worthy of mankind is what you need to be a part of. And it goes far beyond the church.
Anyone to join me in a... Beautiful. Real brief. Can it be really brief?
Yeah.
Please.
We have a family meeting every Sunday just for logistics, to find out where everybody is at and what we're doing, and you know, make arrangements and all that. For years, we tried to come up with a family mission statement, and I couldn't do it. Nothing seemed to fit. The closest thing that I could get was the 13th article of faith. And if you look at that, that it really expresses our desire as a people to seek goodness wherever and to embrace it.
I can sign up for that.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.